Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to the second part of my Cska trilogy. And today's guest is none other than longtime assistant coach Andreas Pistiolis. Andreas talked to me today about his beginnings as a coach, how early he started to coach, the challenges and the paradigm shifts he had as a coach once he started to work at Panathinaikos, experiencing the knowledge of Coach Obradovic and Coach Itoudis, the politics and communication he faces as an assistant coach, whether or not he should exchange playbooks and stuff like that. It was very interesting to talk about that because I faced this problem as well, and we had a nice discussion about it. Also, pre-game, in-game, and post-game questions to ask themselves for coaches, the questions he expects to hear from players, and at the end, we finish up with some personal questions, which was also very interesting to hear. So, once you're done, please leave a review. Please also subscribe to this podcast. And if you still have time, please go to YouTube, also subscribe there. And if you want, just watch the video over there. It's also fun to see us talk and laugh in person. So without further ado, please enjoy Andreas Pistiolis. All right, I think we're good now. We're ready to go. Ella Fille.
Hela, Tiganis.
Kala, kala.
Wow, you're multilingual.
It helps in life. It helps in my job as well. But, you know, I travel so much, I pick up bits and pieces. I can, as long as I can order some coffee anywhere I go, I'm good. It makes me happy. So,
no, it's really important for Greeks to get established like a basketball language the same way the Serbians are. You know, like wherever you go, everybody knows some words in Serbian, even if it's just cursing, you know, or anything else. Everybody knows some words in Serbian because they are the basketball people, you know, the default basketball people. So always for Greeks, it's good to hear other people speak some Greek words. It means we're getting there.
Yes, yeah, for sure. But, you know, like you said, the Serbian nation is very talented in languages. They pick up languages so quickly and really good. You know, it's got to have some linguistical history where they just so many cultures that they have within their culture that they can pick up more languages more easily. It seems like that.
It's interesting, you know, because Balkan people, but also Slavic people,
yes,
great affiliation with Turkic people, and it makes sense.
Yes, yes. So, Andreas, the Cska fraternity works its wonders for me again. We never worked together, but it's been a pleasure meeting you. And now I appreciate you joining my podcast here to talk a little bit about basketball.
It's an honor to be here, considering who were there before, the names. It's great for me and great to see, I mean, great work being done by you. And to be a part of it, it's even greater for me.
It's growing, and you're part of it now. So I don't know. It's a blessing or a curse?
Let's see. Yeah, I see it as a blessing so far. Depends what you got prepared for me, though.
Exactly. For me, it's a blessing, but I don't know. For you, it may be different. No, I'm just kidding. There's not, you know, we're not going to talk about names or situations. It's very... It's an educational podcast for me, and especially for the community. It's not only for basketball community, but I think for coaches, for players, for different perspectives. But before we dive into the work stuff, I wanted to know, how did basketball find you? Where did you pick it up, and where was your first collision?
Oh, well, you know, growing up, my brother is about 5 years older than me. And he was a very good swimmer initially, but then he moved to basketball. He was playing very well in basketball, and I grew up watching him play basketball in his, you know, junior teams, cadets teams, this type of level. But I grew up on the courts watching him. And really, I live downtown Athens in an area called Gizi, where it's like right next to the historical Panathinaikos stadium. So... Mm-hmm. Literally all my life I was over there. I was passing by the gym. So eventually I got involved in playing, you know, following in my brother's footsteps. And I went to play basketball in Panathinaikos. And it just clicked. It was great for me. It was really basketball years in Greece back then. It was like I'm born 78, about 87 was the really breakout of Greek basketball when we won the EuroCup for the, EuroBasket for the first time. And after that, it became really popular. We started going to the Final Fours. Greek teams started building up. We had Nick Gallis then, Giannakis, this great generation of Greek players. And it was a thing to do, you know, and it was easy. You know, I could go play basketball by myself. I could go with friends. It was everywhere in Athens, especially downtown, not a lot of space to go play football or something else. So basketball was the thing to do if you want to go outside. So, you know, I came in contact with the sport and I loved it ever since, and it became a big part of my life.
It's funny you say that, because Kostas had the same influence. You know, the winning of the EuroBasket was the culture changer in terms of basketball in Greece. So it's interesting. Mm-hmm. There's another confirmation from your side about that. So it's truly it was truly a big influence for the whole nation.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's not easy to describe what kind of impact it had to the Greek society at that time and to all the young kids that wanted to go into sports. They would choose basketball really easy. It was everywhere. It was popular. It was growing. We had a lot of good role models from basketball. So it was the obvious choice for our generation, at least.
But when did you decide to be a coach? When did you know that this is what I want to be?
With no exaggerations, that was about the age of 14.
That was quick.
That was quick, yeah, because, you know, I realized I was not going to be a basketball player. You know, I wasn't bad or anything, but I knew I didn't have what it takes. And somehow with the kid that... in my school, when we were gathering up to play with all the other kids, I would make them, no, we're not just going to go like that. We need to know a play. And I would take my teammates in school and teach them plays in order to be organized. And I will just enjoy that so much. So I knew first of all, that I didn't want an office job in my life. I didn't want to work in a bank. I didn't want to work like a civil servant. This is not what I wanted to do. I wanted to be in basketball. And I knew that I was not going to be a player. And I already had from really young age a tendency to like these things, you know, to watch basketball and see how things happen and why things happen. And this coaching stuff, you know, what the instructions that coaches gave us, I liked it. I never forgot a play when I was young. I had it in me, you know, and it made sense to me that I would do that.
High IQ player that translated right into the coaching realm. But when you coached kids too, right? You coached kids in the beginning. How did you enjoy that?
Oh, I loved it. You know, it's funny in my work, because when I was coaching, my first job was at 18. As soon as I finished school and I entered the university, and I already wanted to start on my way to be a coach. My very first job was to coach 6-year-old kids. During the season, I picked up more and more and more because, you know, I just wanted to work anywhere. And I didn't care about making money. I didn't care about how many hours I would work. So I would volunteer to be assistant coach in junior teams. And slowly, I started to coach more and more kids than older kids, and worked my way up. But when I was coaching these teams, I was really not seeing it as a stepping stone. I didn't imagine I would be where I am right now. I thought I was doing that and I was focused on that. And I really loved that. You know, I loved working in basketball. I loved working with young kids. I loved shaping their character. You know, the interaction I had with them, the seeing the impact I had in their mentality. Yes. That was a really rewarding thing. And I loved it. And somehow, I got carried away because, you know, I was teaching them to be the best version of themselves. And when I started improving myself, I just had to take the next step. Even though it wasn't like I didn't like coaching kids, I had to go to the level up when the opportunity was given. And every time it was like that, and somehow without really aiming when I started to be where I am right now, I found myself just by doing my work the best way I could.
Yeah, you basically focus on the moment and focus, lived in, like Shara said, live in the moment. Like you took one step at a time, and then naturally the evolution comes, and then doors open up, and you automatically want to take a next step. I remember, I grew up in Germany, you know, so I was 17. I went and left to the States to play, but before that I was still in Germany. I was playing, and they also had me coaching, which is a problem, I think, where kids coach kids, you know. But there was it's a small town, and I was like 16. I was coaching 14, 15 year olds that were like just a notch below me, 16, 17, and they were like under 16, you know. And I was, you know, I did what coaches did to me. I coached them the way I was coached, and then naturally, but you know, the competitive spirit comes out. You start, you know, getting more aggressive, and you see, at that age, obviously, you don't know how to handle certain situations. And I remember, I regret it to this day. I regret it. I don't forget it. That I had a kid run suicide because I was so pissed at him, and I had him. Like, I mean, this is a cardinal sin. I had him touch every line with his nose because I was just so pissed. Like, you have to go down and go up. And I mean, it was a disaster. I shouldn't have done it. And if he's listening by chance, by one in a million chance, I apologize because it was dumb. But I was like 16, 17. Yeah. I didn't know better. I would never do that. It was a crazy situation. But that's when the competitive spirit comes out. You start, you know, when as a kid, you're not supposed to, you know, be in that position unless you're just completely focused on coaching. Yeah. But when you came up the ranks and then you got the job to be at Panathinaikos, you started as a scout, correct?
Yeah.
Was that a natural progression to get picked up and become a scout at Panathinaikos, or like how did the doors open for you, and what was the, because I get asked often, how did you get to this position? And I think everybody has their own path. There is no one path, you know. There is like everybody has to, you know, draw out their own destiny.
Well, you know, I had some interaction with the men's team back then because I was coaching the junior teams. And a lot of times, as you know, in pre-seasons, we had to go and use a lot of juniors in the pre-season because you had players in national teams and so on. So usually, like, I would have some interaction with the men's team by going there, introducing them, like, this is our select players. This is the players that maybe can make it. Then we do some practices. They would pick whoever they wanted. And that was it. But, well, there was a season, a very defining season for me with a lot of background, which we shouldn't waste any time on anyway, but it was a very successful season for me. So back then, Panathinaikos was really not investing in their junior teams, you know, in their youth programs. It was just the men's team, like a lot of money in the men's team, a lot of great names, really, but the junior teams and all these teams, we were really left on their own devices. We just had to make do with whatever we could find. However, I managed that season to win the regional championship with my team, a team that nobody really appreciated, a team that nobody really thought that they would go far. I got some attention on me. And that was when the door opened, like there was an opening. Dimitris Itoudis was looking for one person to take the workload of him because, you know, he was doing a lot of work back then and he was doing almost everything by himself. He had another associate, so he needed to disengage from that. They needed people also for individual practices. You know, they needed an extra person. So I got given the chance back then to be in the men's team. That chance I took because what I need to mention is that at some point, like, in my career, whenever I took a step forward, I really did it when I was sure I wouldn't take a step back after. I really wanted to be on firm ground. So at some point when I was a lot younger and a lot less experienced, somebody offered me like the opportunity, like, you know, I could get you in the men's team. They knew somebody, they could maybe put me over there. But I was, if I take this opportunity right now, I'm not ready for it. I'm going to blow it.
Yeah.
And you know, I wasn't ready for it. Like I was coaching like 13-year-old kids, I don't know even if they would pick me back then, but it is important for me that even though somebody gave me an opening back then, I didn't take it because I knew I was going to blow it. So, but the second time when this happens, and you know, I got a second chance, which is big, you know, not a lot of people can claim that.
Yeah.
But I was ready for it. And I went there, I work a lot, I proved my worth, I convinced them, and then I got upgraded to an assistant coach. But this, back at the time, to answer your question, didn't really happen. Not a lot of coaches got upgraded from the junior teams to go to the main team. And usually in Greece back then, the assistant coaches were mostly ex-players that they wanted to be positioned over there, get some working experience, and then become head coaches themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, it's funny that you say that. I didn't know that that was like that you turned it down at first and then you had a second opportunity, because I can. Yeah,
it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like a Dimitris or Zeliko came and told me, we want you. And I said, no, somebody could have given me a chance. Somehow, you know, they knew people that they knew people, they could put me there, but I didn't want that chance. I wasn't ready for it. And that kind of was a theme for me. Like when I got the chance, I really needed to know I deserve it, and I was ready for this also.
Yeah, you want to be, you want to feel that you're wanted. You know, you want to feel that you are like invited to stay, and that you have certain expectations, and not just be a guy next to the other guys, but one of the, you know, main guys on the staff. And I can tell you, my first, when you get like, I was in second division Germany. I came to CSKA out of nowhere, basically. And then after Kozlauskas left, I had the opportunity also, like you said, you had somebody inviting you to go join Panathinaikos, and somebody came from the Celtics and also offered me an opportunity early on. And that was like, you got to imagine, within 2 years, I have a progression of like from second division to through CSKA to the NBA. And I was like, this is, I don't think I'm ready for that. Like, this is way too much. And I knew that Messina was coming, and it was an opportunity where the team wanted to keep me. And I was like, okay, I will grow much more in these 2 years I didn't know how long it would last, but obviously that was another opportunity. And then 2 years later, Celtics came again and offered also a different position. So then I felt like I was ready for a different challenge also. But with your job, with your early assignments, where did you have the most struggles with when you came in? And like, what were the biggest challenges you dealt with at that time whenever you joined the staff?
Well, you know, when you start working, and I think just about anything people start to learn, and this happens a lot to young people, when they start learning some things and acquire their first knowledge, they start to believe that they know everything. And when I went to the men's team, I was about that guy, that I really started to understand and acquire knowledge. And I thought, I'm ready, I got this. And then I had to talk about basketball with Zeliko and Dimitris. And very quickly, I realized, thank God, that I knew nothing. And I was here to learn, you know, and I shut my mouth, I opened my ears, and I just had to listen. And it was really hard to keep up sometimes. You know, these guys were best coaches in Europe at the time, and they were really advanced. And it was really hard for me to keep up. And it was really hard for me because, you know, I was about 26, 27 at the time. So even some of the players were older than me and more experienced than me. You know, sometimes talking with Mike Batiste about basketball, I'm coming like a coach and he's the player. And he knew a lot more than I did back then. And a lot of these guys, you know, sometimes, you know, explaining me things. And that was really intimidating in the beginning. But I was really focused, you know, on earning my keep back then and do whatever I have to. Like, I really did anything. Like, even, you know, carry the balls, whatever I had to make myself useful and get my knowledge over there and grow like a coach after that.
Yeah, that's I can totally relate to that, but I'm not going to go into that again. But it's funny, we have never talked about this deep, so I'm glad we're exchanging this information now. And you already answered my next topic I wanted to ask you, is the paradigm shift that some coaches have, or whenever you go into a new atmosphere and you feel like, oh, I think I know a lot and I think I know everything. And then all of a sudden it's like, you know, like I always tell people Quinn Snyder was the one who told, like, who completely opened my sphere of like understanding of the possibilities in basketball. So like that's obviously like working with Jelko and Etudis, you had plenty of those moments, but is there any lesson, anything that stands out the most from that time with them that you feel like, man, that was a particular moment that I completely shifted my mind in certain terms of understanding?
Well, you know, it's one thing that they were repeating, and Dimitris and Zeliko, it's like that you have to be ready for everything a player may ask. So you have to be completely knowledgeable, and you have to have a complete understanding of what you're saying and why you're saying it, because the players are going to ask questions, and sometimes these questions are actually both genuine questions but also tests. And if you fail that test, you lose the trust of the player. So you have to be always ready to answer whatever the player is going to ask you, to prove yourself to him and establish a relationship that this guy knows what he's talking about. So this was really important, you know, to, before I say something, before I could go into something that I was going to explain to a player, I had to have complete understanding of it, and I have to be ready to ask any type of question that a player may have on that. So that was really the most important, you know, how to play the pick and roll. These things change, basketball changes, it evolves, but this is constant. You always have to know your things, your stuff when you talk to players.
Yes, you have to anticipate basically the questions that may arise, whether it's about the opponent, whether it's about your own system.
You know, if you really got deep knowledge of what you're talking about, you won't have to anticipate. You will be ready to answer.
True. Yeah, true. Like there has to be a certain foundation that you have your skill set ready, and whichever knife, fork, spoon, whatever you need, you can pull it out at the right time. All right. So now that we get all this good stuff out of the way, let's go to work. We have a 40-minute game ahead of us right now, and
I'm ready.
I prepared five topics that we're gonna go into one after another. The first one is politics. Okay, so politics. It starts usually off the court with certain things that are maybe with different other teams. So I had these situations a lot, and the question that I find myself always asking or being asked is, can we exchange playbooks? Can we exchange certain information about other opponents that can help the other team? And I would like to know, before I tell you what I think, I would like to know what your experiences with that, and what information you're willing to exchange with other teams in the league or other leagues.
I'm pretty open with that. You know, I believe that information should flow between us, between coaches, between coaching staff. You know, exchanging a playbook or exchanging ideas is not like somebody's going to steal knowledge from you. And really, this is something that helps everybody evolve, you know. And we're all doing, like, there should be a camaraderie between the coaches and especially the assistant coaches, mm-hmm. but we have to grind a lot all through the season. But unfortunately, I see that's not the case with everybody. And this really annoys me when I see people, you know, okay, I understand somebody not wanting to share a playbook. I understand not wanting to share your playbook. I don't understand sometimes not wanting to share the opponent's playbook. You know, sometimes I'm not going to get somebody else to do all my work for me. But, you know, sometimes it's a play. I didn't see the call. I may call somebody to give me the call. Usually, most of the times, we exchange this information more easily. But some guys don't. And really, what annoys me really when I see it is when people try to hide their games in preseasons, like really go out of their way to hide a preseason game so it will not be on Synergy, or we will not find video of it, or it will not be videotaped. I mean, how much is this going to help you really? And why be that guy? I don't like that. I'm not like that. I never had any issue with sharing knowledge with people that ask me, you know, with people I meet in the job. You know, there's some limit to it, of course, of what you can share. But I think, like, if I talk with somebody and I give him 10 information and he gives me one, like if we could quantify it, I still get one.
Yeah,
I still win from this. It's not a contest who gets more, you know, so I got better by this. So I'm really a big fan of it, even though that is not the current mentality of all coaches in Europe, I would say.
Well, we're going to have a debate now quickly. Not quickly. We can take our time.
Yeah.
Because I'm the anal guy that usually is hesitant to exchange other teams' playbooks or play calls or whatever under a certain circumstance. Because I've suffered PTSD probably because I had a bad experience. And then after that, you're kind of like, forget it. Like, yeah. Why should I do it? I agree with you on the video. The video part is definitely annoying, and it's something that, like, come on, we're all watching the same tape, and whatever information I can get from it, it's gonna be, like, I can give you also a video that you can break down the way you are used to breaking film down, and it's up to you. It's just like fair game. But with the play calls and with the, like you said, like the assistant coaches, the scouts, we all put a lot of time and effort into accumulating and doing the work. And if you're doing the work properly, and I would consider myself and yourself probably as well, I'm certain of it, of doing the work properly with preparing everything fully. And then you exchange it with somebody and you get, okay, you say 10 to 1, but sometimes you get like the quality of how you present it or how you give it to them. You get something that's handwritten back, and that's not even like, I trust my work that I put in of scouting the same team that I'm asking for information of more than I would trust other person of doing the work for me. You know, like I trust my work that I put in more than I would trust other person doing the work. So I had a bad experience, but I had one also scout. Well, back then in Euroleague, it's also where it's groups, and then, you know, when you qualify and you have another, you have nothing to lose basically. I was talking to a scout, I'm not going to say from which team, but if he happens to listen, he'll know. It's something that where both of us know we put in the work. Because for me, I don't like free ballers where they just kind of, they want to get something for free without putting in the work, right? I would like to know that you did hustle. And what I did with him was we compared notes, basically. I asked him, like, about the play, you know, like, which play, like, you know, zipper, pick and pop, mm-hmm. and short action, and blah, blah, blah. And then he says, I have, you know, that's two side. Yeah, I have two side as well. Okay, great. So we have both the same thing, and it's like, check, check. And then you move on to the place that he's looking for, and I know he put in the work. So it's not like I'm just kind of giving him, and then, like, here, have a go at it. But it's also a mutual respect for the work you've done, not for the necessarily for you know, the result of it, but for the work you put on.
I agree with most of what you said. So when you exchange information, there should be like a limit to it. What exactly are you doing? And there has to be a way for it. So like I said before, I'm going to exchange information with you. I'm not going to do your work for you. Okay, so if you ask me, let's say, what's that play? I will share it. If you ask me to send you my scouting report, I will not do that.
Okay? Yeah, that's true.
Because
yes.
this has happened also. And then in this exchange of information, we build a relationship, which is either is going to be a good and working relationship or it's going to be the end of it. So if somebody disrespects me with his share of the information or disappoints me with his share of information, probably that's going to be the end of a relationship. But initially, with just about everybody around, especially in EuroLeague level or, you know, in VTB, that will ask initially, I will be open. If
yes.
he doesn't deliver, that's not going to happen again. Yeah, I mean, and definitely, if I feel what you said, like he didn't do his work and he just expects me to hand him knowledge for nothing and him just doing whatever else and go there to his head coach or to his team, acting all wise with my knowledge, that
yes.
I will not accept.
Yes. And that's the same thing. Like I like to compare always life with basketball. I mean, there's so many parallels you can find. It's the same way. I want to be with people as well, and I'm trying to be with people as well. Everybody starts off with 100 points. You know, you start off with 100 points. I'm giving you my trust. I would like to. I'm a believer in people. I want to believe in people, and that's how I would like to also believe in staff members and other. You know, the coaches' fraternity is pretty strong, and that's why I also would like to be able to trust people. But then, as you said, as soon as you feel that there is a certain amount of like unappreciation, then mm-hmm. you're losing points on the scale from 0 to 100, you know, and
It's like you said, that's life. It's not just basketball. That's life. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So moving on from this, like politics, but also there's, you know, politics communication slash communication, because I'm a communication freak, if you want to say that.
Mm-hmm. We know
with relationship with players, right? Like the communication that you have with players, and we're going to go into it a little bit later during the game. But when you have the relationship with players and you have, like you said, you have to be ready for certain questions that you get. But sometimes there is inner conflicts that you have, but you feel like there's the player initially has a point, and you know, like it's not necessarily in agreement, in alignment with the coach or with the rest of the staff, or like how do you handle that if you feel like, man, that's a good point, and do you make the player feel like he's right at that point, and or do you like, let me double check with the coach. Like, how do you proceed with that? Because we all had these conflicts within ourselves, I believe.
Well, it depends. Not everything is the same. What we try to let people know is, like, in basketball, things can be done with in more than one way. So, yeah, you may say something that is right, but we chose to do it differently. So we got to follow that way. So it's like you can reach the same goal with different approaches. It's like more than one path to follow. So we all need to be on the same page on which path we're following. And that doesn't mean it's the only right path. There could be another right path, but we chose, like coaches, that this is the best way. It's really important for me that players feel that they can talk to me and express their concerns or their questions or whatever it is. And I will try to explain them at the right moment, though. Like during a game, I cannot open a debate. Like when the game is being played and the player is in the game, I will not sit and explain him how we reach that conclusion and why we need to play that defense. Yeah. He just needs to know that he needs to play that defense. That's the way we're playing it, period. And then maybe whenever I get the opportunity, I will explain him. But, you know, it's really important also this, that it's really ugly when you get caught at something that is not correct and you keep going with it just because you're being stubborn. It's a big thing to accept when you're wrong, when and also that was Zeliko's thing. Like, if a player had a good idea, we wouldn't hesitate to change the game plan according to the player, what he said. Or, you know, sometimes, you know, a player may have some insight that we don't get. Like, these guys are not screening. I can break through the screen. Don't bring an extra help over there. That's good info. Okay, sometimes you cannot see this clearly from the bench. Yeah. You know, it's something that the player can feel. So it's really also important for us that a lot of times the players feel as a part of the decision-making process.
Yes. Okay, we
have the final say. We have the final say. What we say has to be executed, but until we reach that and until we go to the game, we're open to suggestions, we're open to information, we're open to explaining things, we're open to all of that. But the important thing is this, that, you know, especially like an assistant coach, a lot of times players hesitate to go directly to the head coach with questions. So they will come to you and they need to know that they can come to me with everything. I'm going to reason with them. You know, I'm going to either explain them why we're doing the same we do, or, you know, sometimes if they really have a good input, it's like you said, hold on a minute. Let me go check with the coach now and let's get everybody on the same page now. How are we doing this?
I love that. I really do. I think that's I had coaches on both sides. I had coaches who are categorically against it. And I had coaches, you know, that my father was also like he was considered a player coach, and he was just like always open for suggestions that you don't necessarily have to debate about it, because at the end there is certain, like we still, like the coaching staff still are the ones responsible for the decisions and the final decisions. But they're certainly listen out and like give the players the feeling that they can approach you, not with every single thing, that because the little details can be worked out amongst themselves, but with certain details, like you said, like not screening and don't bring the help. It's good information, and that certainly the players need to feel that they can also suggest that, and that the coaches are flexible enough to accept it.
Just to keep in mind, like, we're talking from our experience, and, you know, I was blessed with working with the highest level of players. you know, in Panathinaikos, in CSKA, even in Banvit, where I work, it was high level players. So yeah, of course you will hear these guys. They got a lot of experience, a lot of basketball IQ with them and everything. And another part, because you spoke about details, though, coaches can get easily lost in overanalyzing details with the players. And sometimes, you know, the suggestion to the player, if the player comes with you with a lot of questions and a lot of details, and what you need to tell him is like, hey, you're overthinking this. Yeah. Just play, just hustle, just grab the rebound, just make it work. Like, how are you going to go over the screen? Just fight your way through the screen. You know, it's details like that. So you need to be balanced. You need to be knowledgeable, but you need to understand also what kind of knowledge the player can handle, what kind of level of detail the player can handle before he starts overthinking and stops hustling and stops putting energy and starts putting his soul into it and just thinking on how it's going to be like on a tactical level.
Yeah, I totally agree. I can't agree more. It's like certain different levels have different expectations and volume of information they can absorb and certain knowledge that is there and sometimes it's not there. So, yeah, I agree. So moving on to the next topic would be off the court slash locker room, specifically a coach's locker room. The staff loyalty is probably the biggest topic of discussion whenever you go into a new staff, whenever you go into a new locker room and you have to establish relationships where head coaches are usually, you know, like the higher you go, the more freedom you have to bring more staff. So you have your trusted people with you. How do you go about cultivating trust amongst the staff? Like I know with players, it's team dinners, it's got players only dinners. But also as a staff, do you guys go out for dinner a lot? Do you guys communicate a lot about different topics that could, you know, help bring the relationship together in order to trust each other on a different level? How do you guys go about cultivating or, you know, in all the locker rooms you've been in?
Well, especially in CSKA, we do have this like traditions with the coaches, like usually the night before the game, which is by definition, opposite to the players, the only free time that we got, because up until the previous night, probably we're doing something, we're working, we're busy. So usually, especially when we go on away games, we always try to just go somewhere, have relax before the game, get some dinner or something, talk about whatever. This creates, you know, personal bonds. And the other part, you know, it's like... You have to build relationship over time. You cannot force things. And in the same way that you will win a player by being consistent and show your knowledge and show what kind of behavior you have and what kind of consistency you have in this behavior, I think this is the same way you will create a good relationship between the coaching staff. So like when an assistant coach that was not a part of the team, we go to CSKA, we need some Russian guys, we got Russian guys over there. Every time they speak, we need to hear them. A lot of times we got similar conversation between us that we have with the player, you know, like we go and devise a game plan. Then an assistant coach may ask, like, why are we doing this like this? What we hope to achieve with that? And we start explaining this and we start these debates and we prove ourselves to each other somehow. And you know that, first of all, we will listen to whatever you got to say. Second of all, we will explain whatever we decided. And then if you got a good idea, we will not be afraid to implement this idea, to adopt this idea and change the game plan or whatever it is that we need to change according to what you suggested. And this over time creates, and actually this is something that especially Dimitris expects from his assistant coaches, you know, he doesn't want them to be like blindly agreeing with whatever he says. And kind of my relationship with Dimitris is an example for the others, what they're going to follow, because really, you know, us being Greeks and you've been around Greeks and you know how Greeks talk. We talk loud. We use our hand gestures a lot. So especially when we went to Russia, people thought that we were fighting all the time. Like we were having a normal conversation that if somebody was around and understand what we were saying, it could be like a social conversation and people thought we were fighting. But a lot of times, you know, it was this conversation, this give and take, like we would be like the devil's advocate for something. Like it might not be necessarily that I disagree with Dimitris' suggestion or Dimitris with my suggestion, but we do the devil's advocate, so we got all our ankles covered. And
yeah,
in the beginning, people seeing this is like, these guys are working together for 15 years, or it looks like they're about to kill each other. But, you know, in our meetings, this is how it works. And then this is what everybody learned from it. Like, you're free to talk whatever you want. You have to prove your point. When you talk about something, you really need to be ready to defend your position and why
justify
you're saying
it. Justify it.
And then when we go out of the coach's room, we're all on the same page. We're all on the same, we got all the same mindset and the same idea. And we are ready to explain to the players and get the players on board and go play the game.
Yeah, that's the thing that I feel like you said, everybody on the staff has to have a voice and feel like they're a contributor and not just a fan or a watcher. You know, like everybody on the staff has a voice. And for me, it was a shocker with Messina where I was destroyed the first month and a half until I learned to justify my opinion and to know, anticipate why certain things have to be a certain way when I try to make a point. And like you said, like as when you get out of the locker room, you absolutely have to be on the same page. Everybody from the head coach till the scout have to know all the rules that we decided to be for that game, for the practice or whatever, because, you know, whenever the players approach you, you have to be ready to answer the same answer. You know, when the player goes to one person and goes to another person, he gets two different answers. It's already messed up. So that's, I think it's so important to get out of the locker room all aligned. Yeah. Did you want to say something?
No.
Okay. So, with all this, we go on to the pregame. Okay. So from this, we move on, we get out of the locker room. Now we go up to the pregame. How do you, with all this, like, preparation and time put into scouting the game, scouting opponents, how much information do you feel is needed for the players? Like, because you go through a filtering process, I imagine. So how much information, if we are living in a perfect world, according to you, is necessary to bring along for the players? Because you cannot implement everything. You know, you cannot tell them everything. I think it's important for you as a staff, for you as an assistant coach, to know the nuances of the opponent. But how many video sessions in a perfect world would you be able would you show before the game? And how much scouting or paper or like plays would you give to the players?
That depends. You know, you have to be ready to adjust what you're doing to your player's capacity of understanding things. And like I said, I had the privilege of working with the highest level of players, so most of the times they can accept a lot of information. It was really interesting, though, to hear Coach Messina mention something in your previous podcast that I completely agree. Like 10 years ago, we would go into every detail. We would watch a lot more video than we do right now. At the moment, we have a lot less information loading for the players than we used to have. And the thing is, firstly, since the EuroLeague became a closed group, this has changed everything. You face each other so many times and the players are kind of known that you can get away with less information. While in the previous system, the top 16, you may play a team for the first time in 10 years. You may play one team 1 year and then play it again in 3 years. And maybe the team is the same players. And the players are not acquainted with them or their system. So you have to really explain them how the player is going to be, how the system is going to be, what you're going to do. At the moment, you know, we go assuming you have the optimal of 3 days to prepare a game. We would probably use the days to split the video into a smallest amount of video we could. So if we have 3 days, we're going to watch 3 days of video, but it's going to be less. If we got 2 days, we're going to cramp everything over there. If we got 1 day, like, you just go for the necessary things because you don't have enough time to prepare, like in back-to-back games, you know, double weeks and everything. Information becomes less important. But, you know, also it's very interesting how the last years, again, in combination with the change of the EuroLeague format, is how everybody right now respects the scouts and the scouting job done from the opponents, and they go out of their way to hide their plays, or to make it complicated for a scouter to get your plays, like either by really having complex plays or having a lot of counter plays, you know, and or even, you know, hiding it during the game. A lot of people will just talk from player to player, or, you know, you're going to go out of your way to do funny things to hide your plays. And, you know, for me, that's a kind of respect of what impact the assistant coaches and the scouters had in the game, that it made it necessary for the head coaches to take that into consideration and change the way they plan their teams and run their plays. So right now there will be teams that really you cannot rely. You play Zenit, for example, Coach Pasquale. It's no way you're going to know what he's going to play against.
I agree.
Like, that's, no way. No way to know what he's going to play against you. It's coaches like that, that you can have like a 300 pages playbook, and he may still surprise you with what you're going to play. So in this situation, you're going to focus more on the players, what you need to do with the player, and or break it down into situations like forget the play. Just this is how we treat the off-screen part of their game. This is how we treat the pick-and-roll part of the game. This is how they treat the low-post part of the game. And in my opinion, like my approach at least to video has changed over the years. Like when I used to focus on plays, now, you know, I'm going to walk through some plays in the practice, but my main focus is on situations or players. Depending on the team, you know, some teams you can really focus just on the players and you got it. You stop this guy and this guy that they do that and you got the job done. Or some situations, you know, it's like, guys, we need to really limit their pick and roll game. And after that, we're not going to have an issue or it's going to be their game is going to be lessened. So I really think I adjusted over the years to that. Like mostly to do more with less, actually.
Yes.
Is what I believe.
I have to agree with you to guard the actions and to focus on the actions more on the plays. I think it's still like the playbook obviously is important because certain plays, when you catch special situations, special plays, Spain pick and roll is the classic example, or any kind of trick plays that can get you and you can get those plays, you can find them in the game to warn the players, you know, time, like in a timely fashion early enough. You obviously still, as the plays, any play is playing out, you still do the job, but the players are supposed to know beforehand, before they go into game, all the rules that they need to know for all the actions, pick and rolls on this side, pick and rolls with this guy, this action, white pin down.
Yeah, so, actually, you know, my job during the game, and this is where the like scouting the opponent playbook comes in play, is like during the game, I have to catch the play, what they're playing, and I have to give an appropriate warning on a player. So whether this is going to be like, this is our free side, whether this is going to be deny the first pass, this is how we do the plays right now, mostly for me at least. Like, I need to know the plays. I will know the plays. I need to know that the players trust that I will know the plays.
Yes.
They don't need
to
remember every play of the opponent by themselves.
Yes.
In Panathinaikos, they did. In Panathinaikos, it was a lot simpler back then, the playbooks of the opponents and everything. But we actually expected the players to know, like when they say to side, what to side is without explaining us from the bench. Right now, you cannot do that, I believe. So we focus on that. Like, I need to know, not only scout it, what the play is, but how do I break that play? And what is the direct instruction I will give to the player? So this is going to be like, what's the back pick? Or deny this first pass, because that's where I know the play is going to break. Or deny the handoff, or something like that. Or this is that play that we also have.
Or you call the player's name, who they're going for. You know, like, hey.
Exactly. Watch out, it's for you, it's against you.
Yeah.
Pick your role against you. Something like that. So, like, really quick information during the game that's going to help the player defend the play.
Yes. Cool. Yep. Very good. But that's one thing. I'm wondering what the schedule you said, like you condense it, you have rules instead of going, you know, like expanding the video sessions. How do you manage your time in general with all the flights, with all this condensed schedule? When do you work? When do you, like, on, I imagine on the plane is a big majority of your time that you spent on your computer. Where do you find balance also to get away a little bit from the game to refresh your mind?
Oh, well, you know, this is when you do this for a long time, you find your way. You become more efficient in your work. Like right now, analyzing a game for me takes far less time than it used to be, like 5 or 6 years ago. I become faster because I got my 10,000 work hours on it. You know, I got so many
job
done on that.
You know that is debunked. It's not 10,000. Yep. It's the quality of the 10,000 hours. It's the quality of the
exactly.
Hours.
Yeah, this is also part. But you know, maybe you cannot master something in 10,000 hours, but for sure you got to be dumb if you put 10,000 hours on something and you don't get better on it. I mean, everybody's gonna get better when they do so many repetitions and spend so much time on something. So of course, in CSKA we got the luxury of. Chartered flights everywhere, so you do a lot of work over there.
Yeah,
and not to start analyzing your excellent paper on how scouting systems work in Europe. You put a lot of work in it, so I believe that I found the perfect system for us, for me and my colleagues to work and be more efficient in less time. So you know, you analyze the whole for the people that don't know that you did a great work. I think you have this published somewhere,
yeah,
on yours,
yeah.
People should take a look at it, it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's there's more things, more of these different styles coming because every method has their own advantages and disadvantages. And I started, mm-hmm. I started with the first simple one where. One guy, one poor scout is the guy who does everything.
And, a very popular throughout Europe, yeah. very popular approach, unfortunately.
Very, very popular approach, outdated approach for all the head coaches out there. But I get it. I mean, I understand the approach to it, but there's other ways of doing it. And I think the more modern we get, the more hands-on the assistant should be as well. And I think that's the right way to do it. So moving on to the in-game, we're getting out of the locker room, we're going to the game, we're stepping on the court. As an assistant coach, as a top-level assistant coach, where do you see your biggest duties towards the head coach? What do you feel like when you come into the game, what are the questions you ask yourself when you mentioned you have to be ready for players to ask you questions? What questions do you feel like you have to be ready for the head coach to ask you and to have you know, to approach these challenges the right way? What are the challenges you deal with?
Well, look, me and Dimitris, we've been working together for so many years. We really know where we need to fill in for each other. So, you know, the assistant coach a lot of times has to find the gaps that the head coach is leaving and fill in the gaps. And compensate for some behaviors and like go opposite from the coach. Mm-hmm. So when the coach mm-hmm. is really active on the bench, and if I start jumping up and down again, that's going to be too technical, really easy. So, you know, I have to be calm. That's kind of my thing. You know, I need to be the calm observer of the game throughout the game. And, even let's say when a defense doesn't work and they score on us, I have to realize if this is the defense that we need to change, or if you know, I have to suggest that we have to keep going with that. It's going to work. Like, yeah, maybe they scored now there. Maybe we were unlucky there, or maybe this was not a good quality mm-hmm. defense. But we have to keep going with it. So I really need to assess everything that is happening in the game according to the game plan, you know, and make my suggestions or my corrections to the game plan that didn't survive contact with the enemy. You know, that's one of my favorite, in spite of being a scouter, this is one of my favorite quotes, like plans usually don't survive contact with the enemy. that was a military maxim anyway. But this happens a lot, so you need to be ready to adjust and compensate. But you know, usually I try to be the calm guy because coach is really emotional and really active during the game, and he's the guy that really needs to be transfer his energy and his aggressiveness to the players. Yes. Sometimes,
yeah,
and that has a downside. A lot of times you get also carried away, so I need to compensate for that. Be the voice of not reason, actually, to be the calm observer. I think this is the best description. So a lot of times, you know, I have to help him out with time management of the players, make sure the rotation is being done correctly so we don't overplay somebody or we don't leave somebody a lot of time in the bench, or, you know, we need to keep the team fresh. And, you know, this adjustment to the game plans, what is working, what is not. During the game, this is the standard things. A lot of times you need to do something that you never did before, or something that you don't often do, but in general, this is the 100% is going to happen, like these situations.
Who, you know, just to get back on your game plan, Mike Tyson also always said that everybody has a game plan or a plan for the fight until they get punched
until
in the
they
mouth.
Get punched. Yeah. Also good line.
Yeah. And then plan change really quickly.
Yeah.
Who keeps track of the minutes of the players on your bench? I mean, like in terms of role, not the person, but in terms of like, is it the assistant coach, the second assistant, the conditioning coach? Who's the person to do it?
Usually I do it, you know.
Okay.
Usually I keep my eye on it.
You look at the box scores.
Like okay. Sometimes, you know, it's just a feel that you know, it's you may look at the minutes, like the stat actually, or sometimes you get a feeling like from the quality that this guy, yeah,
yes,
not a lot of minutes in there, but he just sprint it up and down, and he switched on the defense and he played their player, and then he got the ball on the mismatch on the other end, and then again he defended the ball action, and you know he's tired now, we need to swap him because he just gave a lot of energy and we don't need him to, we need him to be fresh because I know he's going to play in the last 3 minutes of the game, so we need to be in good shape at this point.
Yeah, so even though he may have played for three instead of 3-4 minutes, he played maybe 2 minutes, but he played really intense two and a half minutes that you need to give him a break.
I need to be able to recognize this, yes.
Yeah, yes, yes. Looking forward to towards the end of the game. So what questions do you ask, or what questions do players usually ask you during the game most commonly? I mean, it depends always on the opponent. It depends a lot on from game to game. But generally speaking, where do you find yourself? Which questions do you find yourself repeating themselves the most? Is it like on the defensive end, the offensive end, the adjustments? What after timeouts? Is it certain things that they want you to point out to them?
Well, our most used line in our offense is be aggressive. So this is something we keep repeating. In defense, most of the times, I'm focused on making sure everybody knows what the game plan is. So a lot of times I need to repeat the defensive reaction to the players and make sure that everybody is updated if we change something, if we make some adjustment or some detail of the original game plan that they're not doing correctly. You know, like you're supposed to be deeper over there, you're supposed to be wider, stay with the shooter over there, we don't need that help. Blah, blah, blah. And usually in this type of situations, I have to go to the players before the players have to come to me. Like, what are we playing now? Are we still doing that? You know, because something happened different. And usually that's most of the interactions over there. What do you want me to do with that guy? Or we said, where is that guy shot? He just made 2 out of 2. Do I keep risking? You know, this type of information. And or, you know, some explainings, or, you know, sometimes some like psychological boost, or, you know, like whether this is just you need to calm down, or whether this is you need to keep shooting. I mean, you're a shooter, keep shooting.
Yes.
Shots will fall. We need that. You know, these things are the most standard things that you're going to talk. And like I said, in each game, you know, something else may happen. You need to be ready to adjust. You need to be ready to compensate, all these things.
Yeah, it's always like you don't know, you're kind of trying to anticipate what the game will bring you. You know, like you have, you know, certain things you feel like the team could do against counter actions, and then you have to also prepare the team or prepare the players to see if they changed, if the other team changed something as well. Because sometimes we show one thing, but you know, high level coaches, like we're talking about Coach Pasquale, he will definitely change something or make some adjustments that you have to also you know, inform the players as soon as possible, as soon as they come in, because things change rapidly. Now we step off the court. We won the game or we lost the game, depending. Maybe there's no difference in terms of the questions you ask yourself or ask, whether amongst the staff or personally, like, could I have done something better in terms of preparation? Or is there something that this game, although we won, we still can learn from, or like in the loss, there's a certain things that you automatically pay attention to, you know, like our pick and roll defense is the main thing for this game, and we just did a horrible job on that. What questions are most common for you after the game that you kind of go back and analyze and reflect on?
Usually after the game, what's in my mind is to keep balance in with What I mean is a lot of times, a lot of people tend to, it's a human thing, you know, to get overexcited with a win or to get overly disappointed with a loss. So, you know, my thing is always, you know, even when you won, you have to keep your head down and see if you actually got better. Why did you win? What did you do correctly? Or see for signs that may lead to a defeat in the future. And in a defeat, you still have to separate, like, why did we lose, and how much this has to change our plans, you know, when what are the real conclusions you can get from any game, you know, or any situation, win or defeat, because a lot of people get emotional after losing, and a lot of people get overexcited after winning. And when you're losing, you start to jump into conclusions that are not real.
Yes.
Just because you're disappointed from the defeat. And a lot of times when you win, you get blinded by the win and not see the signs that will later on create more problems for you than they needed. And, you know, it's a common thing to say that a defeat sometimes will teach you more than a victory. You know, sometimes yes. You can learn and actually be a turning point for you or a crucial point in your season, a defeat more than a victory sometimes. So once again, I try to look at things objectively after the game, analyze our game, and make real conclusions, free of emotion, free of personal disappointment or personal excitement, and try to make sure we're on the right path and don't get blinded by victory or defeat.
Yeah, that's this gray area. That's the most important thing and the most difficult thing to analyze and to break down, because, like you said, you can get a false sense of security when you're winning and you feel like you're doing the right things, and then all of a sudden there's just like a tornado hits you on during a game where you just completely annihilates you, and then all the weaknesses show off all of a sudden, and then drama comes out of nowhere. But if you were just really reflecting game by game and seeing these small details that it's leading to something bad, if you see the signs, if you catch them early enough, you can prevent this from happening. And I think that's the most important thing you said in this topic, that it's really important to foreshadow of what could possibly happen, of the small details that are maybe not being picked up because the winning just glosses over everything, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's
the hardest to convince people of, like,
yes,
when somebody scores a shot and it's a bad shot, it's hard to go tell him, like, we cannot win with this type of shot. But it's like, yeah, but I made them, so he got a point there. But it's hard to explain him, yeah, you can make them, but you cannot win games like that.
Yes.
Or leagues like that, or titles like that. You know, you cannot win the titles with this type of shots.
Yes, so yes, titles.
Yeah, it's really hard to be the, how to say this, the guy that breaks the party. You
the
know,
bad the guy.
when everybody's happy, tell me, yes, but...
there's something I can find there. The ball breaker.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but it's you know, try to explain that to people. When you win, sometimes you win, but you lose. But when you lose, sometimes you win, because like you won, but you were just making horrible shots the whole game. You lose, but you were defending your butt off, and the opposing team was making tough shots all night long. You executed the game plan. The game plan was good. They just made like crazy pull-up shots, crazy fadeaways, and like some nights are just like that, and you just have to acknowledge it and move on. And that's the hardest thing that's why within the staff and within the whole organization, there has to be a certain, everybody has to be on the same page to acknowledge that. That's like, yes, like we see that as well, and that's the most important thing.
That's also very hard, you know, everybody to be on the same page, especially for things like that, you know, because a lot of guys just see the result and...
Yes, yeah, but it's natural. It's natural.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, it's natural. At the end, the loss is a loss. There's the L in the loss column, and that's all that counts. So at the end, I mean, that's the job of a coach, right? So, What after the game, do you do a, it obviously depends probably on the schedule, but at least one video for a post video, is there a certain time frame that you're trying to keep it to, or is it just game dependent, certain clips? Sometimes I had seen it before also where you, in order to prepare for the next game, you take certain things from the past game that you played against a different opponent and you implement it into the next opponent of certain things that stood out and are very, could be applied to the next opponent as well.
Well, ideally, we do try to analyze our own games and see highlights from the game we just played. But sometimes the time is relentless. You cannot do it. Yeah. You know, you sometimes what we try to do is compare situations. You know, like this guy's played a pick and roll defense like this. And you guys, you remember that play yesterday, how you behaved on the same in a similar situation. You didn't defend it well. And look at these guys, how they defended. You know, also get some motivational things done over there. Definitely, most of the games you will see more or less, and most of the points you have to make like a coach, they will see more or less, especially even if it's not directly after the game. It's going to be on the second round. It's going to be somewhere you need to show things. And sometimes it's just, you know, because you don't have the time to show to everybody, you know, maybe to a specific player, you prepare some edit for a player and you go show it to him in private. Like over here, you had to do that instead of, if it's just for one guy, instead of showing the whole team, wasting time over there and keeping the team more time in the video room and showing everybody a highlight that addresses a specific player. Yes. Yeah. Sometimes you may go to some individual video with that. But the truth is, the time is so packed, you know, with travels, with back-to-back games and everything, that sometimes you just don't get to do it as much as you should.
Yeah, the individual sessions are sometimes much more worthy, you know, like they're, especially in a condensed schedule, you're on the road, you're in the airport, hey, let's come here, let's sit down, I want to show you 2-3 clips and just to show certain things that matter the most, you know, and the filtering process, I feel like that's the most difficult part to really filter out. And 2-3 clips, like Coach Messina said it, you know, in San Antonio, sometimes there was like a preparation process where they just showed like one clip that just sums it up everything. Everybody gets together, watch in the video session, one clip, you address the topics that are most relevant for now and for the next opponent and its general principles, and then you just move on. You don't, time always wins. you can't compete with time. So we both won the game. We won this game. And now we're moving into you always win anyway. But we go into the last personal five. I would like to have you start sometimes with a starting five, but it's not always the strongest five, right? Like sometimes the sixth man is just as important or maybe just as relevant. And now I want to finish off with the strong five with you, and doesn't necessarily have to have basketball answers. It's also maybe more on a personal basis. The first one would be, where do you see yourself still improving the most? I don't know if you believe in lifelong learning in terms of like just acquiring knowledge, acquiring certain skills, just a wider range, wider spectrum of skills. Where do you see yourself still improving the most, and what's the thing that you still would like to be better at? What's one thing you would point out?
Oh well, that's a deep question. Now
I know I'm deep. I'm a pretty deep guy.
yeah, you are. Look, I do believe in lifelong learning. Like you always improve, you always learn something, and sometimes you know from the most unexpected sources, you know, somebody's going to teach you something, some guy you never expected. And like I said, like I learned almost the same amount of basketball from good coaches that I learned from bad coaches. You know, I learned, I'm proud of that actually, you know, that I learned from the good examples and I learned from the bad examples. So definitely, you know, as a person, what I'm proud of is of my work ethics and my knowledge on my subject and everything. I am not a people's person, you know, and this is something I would like to improve in the. I'm trying to improve, you know, to be
socializing more.
More social guy. You know, even sometimes. Even though I have great relationship usually with the players, and not the kind of great relationship with the players that I always tell them what they want to hear or just befriend them, you know, the kind of relationship that I will be, because like an assistant coach, you get to be a little bit more friendly with players than you get to be like a head coach, but also, you know, tell them off when I have to, you know. So in that aspect, you know, with people that I spend time, I'm good. With people that I don't spend so much time with, I'm not that good. But on the other hand, you know, it's really important for me, whatever I do, to be genuine. You know, if I don't have it, I don't have it. You know, I don't like to force situations or to act like somebody I'm not. I don't know if I really can improve. I'm trying to improve, but I don't really know how to improve because, you know, I'm like a dog. You always know what I'm feeling. On that part, you know, if I don't like you, you're gonna know. If I like you, you're gonna know. I'm like that, and for me, this is something I find keeps me back. You know, throughout my career, this has been something of an impediment on my progress like a coach. So this is something I like to improve. A weakness I do accept. In general, you know, I like to be blunt with myself and like to be myself's worst critic without being the guy that put myself down, you know, beat myself up for everything. But really, like I said, you know, when I try to promote myself as a coach, what I have to show is my work, what I have to show is my knowledge. And the other part is where it's keeping me back and it doesn't allow me to make myself known. You know, I'm not the kind of guy that go around, talk to journalists and shake hands, you know, be a politician in that aspect. So this is something I struggle with and I try to improve. And of course, you know, knowledge is something that never ends, you know, to keep being up to date with your sport. And the fact that you've been a hard worker until now is not a guarantee that you will keep being a hard worker. So, you know, just trying to build, like keep my qualities and build on them.
Yes. Improve the volume of it, you know, just to grow in all directions. But I think, like you said, like being genuine and being just, you know, open to certain situations, because the certain situations dictate your behavior, you know, like usually, like I'm not the guy also to go everywhere and to talk to everybody. I'm a little bit reserved in that aspect, but whenever I do talk to somebody, I would like to be there, fully there, you know, and not completely, you know, all over the place. I would like to be focused on one person and then maybe it's a group, but then you also make genuine connections. But I'm like, you know, people say networking, it's not networking. Like networking does not work when you go, you just kind of network just to be talking to somebody and getting to know, you know, that they would know you. You know, like that's not, that shouldn't be the goal. The goal, and Mike Schmitz actually posted that a couple of weeks ago, go with the intent to make a friend, you know, like when you go, like you really, your intent, like I also, like I say, like I want to give everybody 100 points from the beginning. And that's when you start off. And then that's naturally, you know, our community is small relative to other spheres, soccer sphere or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like our community is relatively small. Word travels fast. And then all of a sudden you like, your reputation, your anything precedes you before you even get there. So I think just being genuine, being yourself and trying to make, you know, genuine friends along the way. If you would have asked me 10 years ago if I can share my playbook with you or the opponent's playbook with you, maybe wouldn't be sitting here. So who knows? But yeah. Life changes. But the second thing I was going to on this last finishing five, one dream you have, you want to, would like to achieve. You know, we had like a quality that you would like to improve, but one dream you would like to achieve that you would like to have in your bucket list that check off.
Well, look, professionally, you know, I already achieved a lot as an assistant coach. You know, I got a
It doesn't have to be about basketball.
Everything. Yeah. On a personal level, I'm good. You know, I got my family, which is really important for me. I had a very interesting life, you know, moving around. And this is a big deal for me that I got to move out of my country and get in touch with different cultures and different people and learn things from them and see how things are getting done a different way. So, you know, probably my dream is to repeat all this on a different level, you know, not like an assistant coach, but like a head coach one day. And if possible, to be as successful as was as an assistant coach, to repeat this in a head coaching level. Other than that, I'm pretty happy. You know, it's like I told you before, like I was in a junior team's coach and I was happy to be there. You know, I didn't actually aim to go and be a EuroLeague champion or anything, but it happened because I was always making sure I was doing my best at everything. So in the same way, you know, I'm happy where I'm at right now. Happy with my wife, happy with my kids, happy with my dogs, happy with my house, whatever, my family. And on a professional level, just I need to level up. And, you know, when I level up, I will need to level up a little bit more. And, you know, just step by step, but always a step forward. And like I said before, this is my goal in life. Like whenever I take a step forward, to be a firm step, to make sure that I will never take a step back after that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like you are a very content person. Like you are happy with your surroundings. You're happy where you're at. It's just that naturally the level up to go to the next tier. It's a natural evolution.
You know, don't get me wrong. You know, I am an ambitious person. And, I do appreciate the correct way of ambition also on others. But at the same time, being ambitious doesn't mean that you should be grateful for whatever you have and to be disappointed with what you have already achieved. So I want to be going forward and being on the next level, you know, every time. But at the same time, I know I'm at a good place right now.
Yes. Man, I don't have the quote. I have so many good quotes and I didn't write this quote down. I had posted the other day and, I don't want to butcher it because it's too good of a quote, but if you go on my social media back a little bit thinking of basically is if you think about it's if you I'm not going to try
okay people follow Benas on Instagram and on Facebook and you're going to find it's a great quote, I'm sure.
Exactly it's a beautiful quote. If not basketball, what would have been the path for you?
Look, like I said, this is the path I chose for myself since I was 14. If I wasn't, I probably would be either a children's teacher or something, you know, teaching people because I like that.
Yeah.
Or something like a dog trainer, honestly. Like this is, I don't know why, but I thought I'd be great at this, you know. Like, and I like dogs more than people, you know. And I would do that. But I think most likely, I had failed, probably I would be, because finishing the university in Greece, I qualified to be both a basketball coach or, you know, to go work at a school like a physical education teacher. So that would be a possibility. Not a desk job, which is funny to say when you spend most of your time over a laptop analyzing over a computer, but I wouldn't be like the guy that works at a bank or that's not me.
Yeah, I agree. I can't see myself working. I mean, never say never. Like, you know, like life can change. Life can play tricks on you anytime possible. And I consider myself just as you. I consider myself lucky and really fortunate to be, you know, having this freedom of like working a job that where you can really, I mean, team concept, you're on team schedule, but I'm on a different schedule. It's not the 9 to 5, the classic approach, and it has its pros and cons, obviously. But I'm really grateful, and I think I would find it hard to go to that now after living life in a different way the past, you know, 20 years or forever. If you had to teach a class, which you like to teach, if you had to teach a class in coaching, what would the first lesson be in the class? The first lesson that you would teach?
Accept your ignorance and accept your limitations. You know, like, don't think you know everything already. Don't think you need to be perfect at everything. You know, accept that you don't know something and that you're here to learn, and accept that there are some limitations or something that you're not going to be good at. And it's okay to be like that.
Be humble. Be humble and don't
That's
be afraid.
Always a good thing.
Yes. Don't be afraid to admit to mistakes if there is that you we all, if you don't, if you're not humble, then you're playing with hubris, you know, and then you will get humbled at some certain.
You're not going to improve, you know, because
yes,
when you start learning, and if you don't accept that, that you don't know and you're not perfect, you're not going to become good at what you're doing. You know, if you act perfect, if you think you know everything, that's only going to be an impediment to your improvement. You know, you can't do that. So if you're here to learn, be ready to learn, accept that you need to learn.
Yes, I can't agree more. And last one, is there a sliding door moment in your life where things could have twisted one way and it just could have turned out completely different, whether it's on or off the court? What is it?
Look, twice in my life, I resigned from my job, and that could have gone either way. You know, one time in junior teams where I wanted something more, I wasn't being given that because I believe I wasn't appreciated much. So it was like, either you give me this or I resign.
Yeah.
They thought I was bluffing. You know, I'm not the kind of guy that bluffs, though. So I had to make sure that everybody knows I'm not the kind of guy that bluffs. When I say it, I mean it.
Yeah,
and somehow that worked out for me, though I resigned initially. Then they came back, they offered me the job that I wanted. And this is, you know, that was the year that I said I had a breakout year with the junior teams of Panathinaikos. And then I get noticed from the men's team. In the summer before I got that job and do that season, I had resigned.
Mm.
And they gave me this job back. And then after Zeliko left from Panathinaikos and Dimitris, I stayed over there. You know, Panathinaikos is a top-level team in Greece, so people don't leave, especially assistant coaches. You know, people that are not important. If you're not Zeliko, you just don't just leave from Panathinaikos. But I wasn't happy with my role there. I understood why things were like that. I understood why I was given the role I was given. I just was not happy with it. That was not me. I thought I deserved better. So instead of being a bad assistant coach that stays over there and he talks bad about the team or the head coach or, you know, situation he doesn't like, instead of being the guy that nags all the time and he complains all the time, I chose that the most honorable thing to do was just to move on, to quit, which shocked a lot of people because, like I said, people don't really quit from Panathinaikos. And up until that point, nobody ever resigned mid-season, like an assistant coach from Panathinaikos. And, you know, back then, I lived all my life in this club. You know, I started from the junior teams. And up until that point, I never moved into a different club. I was always in the same organization and the same system. And a lot of people believed, like, even around me, like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, they looked at you like you're crazy.
Yeah, exactly. You just left the possible job you can have. And like I said, I think I said it maybe even to you, like that was a point that make or break.
Yeah.
It really worked out for me. It really, really worked out for me. I didn't expect it. It wasn't a given for me that it was going to go this way. I was fully conscious that, you know, either I was going to be somewhere better and I get what I wanted, what I believed that it was what I deserved, or I would be becoming a dog trainer or you know, whatever it is that I was going to become. And like I said, I would either way get what I deserve. You know, I had to know. So that was two really important moments for me that I took a leap of faith on my abilities and on myself, and it really worked out for me.
Yeah, you stayed true to your principles and to yourself, and at the end of the day, you won. So it's kudos to you for having the balls to do it, because at the end, it worked out really well.
It worked, you know, but I'm fully knowledgeable that even when I'm the same person, it would have very easily gone the other way.
Very easily
be the end of my career, but, you know, I had to do what I had to do.
Yeah. No, it's good. I mean, like, you can look back on it now. So one last thing, what are some final thoughts you would or advice you would give to other assistant coaches out there to be better assistant coaches, be a better version of themselves?
Well, don't take yourself too seriously. you know, because a lot of assistant coaches do that. Maybe from insecurity, maybe from trying to project confidence. A lot of times we become a little bit act too self-important. And I've been there, done that mistake, and I thank God I corrected it really, really quick. And pretty much like what we said before, accept that you need to improve all the time, that you always have something to learn. And, you know, probably hard work always pays. You know, a lot of times, a lot of people in all professions, not just in a basketball profession, may get a job that they don't deserve, you know, because of connections, because they knew somebody, yeah. because somebody yeah. helped them get there. But you always keep the job because you deserve it. So
yes,
if you, like, in the end, you know, hard work, knowledge of your profession, of your craft, never goes to waste. Never goes to waste. So you need to keep building on that. And then the other things are also important. You know, you need to be a people's person. You need to have your connections and everything and to get the opportunities. But that's your base. If you don't have that, whatever opportunities you're going to get, you're going to waste them.
That's a perfect way to end it. Andreas, thanks a lot for your time. Thanks a lot for all the knowledge you shared today
with
us. Thank
you for having me.
Yeah, and we'll be in touch. And everybody, don't make your younger players like me run suicides and touch the nose.
I've done some mean things when I was coaching kids, but never that.
I'm a mean guy. I look like nice. But all right, yeah. Bye, everybody. See you.